We have today Department of Environmental Conservation and the Department of Corrections. Commissioner Sander, would you like to join us, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Pleasure to be at this Senate Finance Committee meeting. I believe a substantial amount of materials have been given to you. I have a statement that I formally prepared, which I'd like to summarize, if I could, and relate our objectives to the budget itself. I have with me key members of the staff that can respond to specific questions regarding special program elements that you may be interested in. I want to first of all focus attention on the primary objectives of the Department of Environmental Conservation for fiscal year 93-94. We have quite a partnership program going with communities and boroughs, conferences, and also with the Defense Department agencies, and we want to continue to build that. We want to implement the Alaska Water and Sanitation Task Force recommendations. And in our view, the number one environmental health problem is the condition of the water and sanitation systems in the rural communities. We are realistic about this. We have a backlog of $1 billion by our estimates, 1.2 actually, 1.4 by the Public Health Service, just to bring them up to minimum health standards and start a proposal to have matching funds, about $25 million state and $25 million federal, to get on with this program over the next 20 years. We want to work with the Environmental Protection Agency, and particularly the new policy of our personnel in the Clinton administration on a number of issues, and specifically the weapons policy that was enunciated by President Bush in August of 1991, but never actually implemented because the process of promulgating the regulations was not complete. We want to assist the EPA in establishing a regional office in Alaska and essentially bring the expertise and policy level people of the Environmental Protection Agency into the state where we can work more closely with them, or if they can be more familiar with what's actually going on, and quite frankly, be more responsive to our needs. We want to complete the revision of the Alaska Water Quality Standards. This is a part of the Clean Water Act requirement for what's called a triennial review. This process continues until the spring and early summer of 1994. We expect to have phase one regulations developed by March 1, and this has tremendous impact and touches, in fact, every individual. We want to maintain state primacy of federal environmental protection programs where federal requirements for primacy are realistic and there is adequate funding to properly administer the program to the required standards. We want to maintain state sovereignty in the administration of these programs. We want to continue implementation of Alaska's tough oil discharge prevention and contingency planning regulations. We've got a lot of contaminated sites to clean up. The Project Chariot near Point of Hope, in Cape Thompson, and that's a high priority item. We want to accelerate the resource and service restoration work associated with the Exxon Valdez Royalstone Trustee Council. And we will work with the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to actually incorporate the actions taken by the Trustee Council for funding programs this year. That happened just this week, and that's not reflected in the materials that were distributed. We want to continue emphasis on environmental research and development, working in partnership with universities. We want to continue focusing attention on North Pacific fisheries problem, wasteful practices. We were successful. The governor personally contacted Administrator Riley of EPA about his attention. We will not have to do that with Carol Browning, the new administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. We want to work with the Northern Forum and other international groups, particularly dealing with the Arctic and subarctic environmental issues and the contamination in the former Soviet Union, which is adversely impacting Alaska's environment and the environment generally. We want to integrate and coordinate DEC activities with DNR and other departments where redundancy and shared responsibilities exist. We want to privatize activities wherever possible. And specifically, Mr. Chairman, I should say co-chairs, I would hope we could enter into a partnership with the Alaska legislature to do a number of specific things. And I've identified these in thinking particularly that since this is the first session of this group that we'll have an opportunity to look at both the year 94 and 95 and really achieve some major objectives. So specifically these. Again, implementation of the Alaska Water and Sanitation Task Force recommendations have already referred to. I think we need to simplify laws and regulations so they're roadmaps instead of roadblocks. Particularly the Wetlands Coastal Zone Management Solid and Hazardous Waste Regulations are particularly a problem. We want to enact an air quality permit bill, which will meet federal Clean Air Act requirements, yet make it tailor-made for Alaska's conditions. A problem with that, Mr. Co-Chairs, is the fact that it's a very expensive bill. From the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990 project out a program that, in fact, requires us to double the numbers of people who work to administer that program. We're trying to work with the congressional delegation in simplifying these kinds of impacts that have impacted life. We want to develop legislation or state policies which will encourage the use of natural gas and other alternative energy sources for motor vehicles. We want to modify existing laws and regulations which will lessen the cumulative impact of environmental regulations on Alaska's smaller communities. And this is something that is under consideration in a number of other states. The generation of an incredible amount of federal laws that have impacted small communities to the point where they're extremely burdened. Part of this stems from the fact that the majority of the members of Congress represent the larger urban areas, and they are trying to deal with environmental problems in those larger communities, and they prescribe conditions and prescriptions which, you know, do not meet the smaller communities. And there is an effort with the National Governors Association to try to get some legislation nationally to lessen that burden. We want to utilize Exxon Valdez oil spill settlement and other funds to complete the acquisition of Katchemek Basin Park and holdings, developing Princeton and Sound world-class recreation area, and restore other resources and services that were injured by the Exxon Valdez oil spill throughout the spill area, including the Kodiak and Cook Inlet areas. We want to provide incentives for pollution prevention and strengthen measures to deter environmental crimes. We did establish an environmental crimes unit in the district attorney's office in Anchorage, and we have been successful in getting some enforcement of deliberate pollution. We want to participate again in this triennial review of the Alaska Water Quality Standards. We want to establish an administrative fair user fee program which encompasses and encourages communities to collect and administer programs to be funded by such fees. And you'll notice, members of the committee, that in comparing the budget of fiscal year 93-94, we depend very heavily on user fees, shifting from general fund to user fees. This is very controversial, a lot of opposition. It is consistent, I believe, with the Economic Summit and other recommendations that those who receive services should pay the fees for those services. So we'd appreciate your guidance and advice on how to administer a fair user fee program. And particularly, we'd like to encourage communities to collect those fees and administer these programs. We firmly believe that the best environmental program is one that is community-based, is operated in partnership of the state working with the local communities, and wherever possible to include the Environmental Protection Agency in that policy effort. We want to strengthen Alaska's emergency response capability for oil and hazardous substance spills from accidents or natural disasters. We have a response fund, which I know many of you are interested in. We have our response fund manager that we discussed this morning, any elements of information or concern that you have regarding that. We want to consider revisions of radiation control protection responsibilities stemming from the State Emergency Response Commission report to the governor. And as I suggested earlier, we want to work together in finding a budget strategy from 1895 and for the balance of this decade. Included in the materials that you have are summaries of the fiscal year 94 operating budget proposals for each of the departments, divisions, and regions. The major changes in DEC's budget proposal for 94 is in the budget structure for the divisions of environmental quality and spill prevention and response. These were formerly one division and has been split into two. And we have also allocated the funds to regions, so I want to hold the regional administrators accountable for the achievement of targets that are associated with funds assigned to them. And I should note that the divisions of facility construction and operation and environmental health will still be administered from the central office. I should note that to achieve general fund reduction objectives, we reduced the general fund allocation for the hazardous waste program to the amount necessary to match grant funds. We had, in the first 2 years of our administration, given more emphasis to hazardous waste management. It was our hope that we'd in fact be able to establish at least one, perhaps preferably three, hazardous waste treatment and disposal sites. It turns out that this process is long, torturous, takes 5 to 6 years at a minimum, and we still intend to retain primacy, to obtain primacy for that program, but we're doing it on the scroll of health. I should point out that the Department of Natural Resources and the ADEC are working together to better coordinate several program activities through dual appointments of personnel working on similar activities. Commissioner Holmes and I are meeting again this morning, in fact, to look at opportunities for having dual appointments and shared responsibilities on the North Slope and the Pipeline Corridor. And water force practices and food inspection programs. So it's our target over the next 2 years to, in fact, save $500,000 in funds by this effort. And our Assistant Commissioner Janice Adair and Pam McCormick, Deputy for the Community Department, of Natural Resources, are working and hoping together on them. Finally, there is attached to the statement somewhat of a historic document in part. It's an operating budget summary for ADC for the years 1990 to 1995. The growth of this department has been largely driven by federal and state environmental laws and regulations, and I'm sure future budgets will be mainly driven by such legislation and regulations. And as I previously noted, tremendous impact of this legislation has, for example, the Clean Air Act, which requires us to hire an additional 25 people, either within state government or locally, or for local communities that can be agreeable to administer such programs. I should point out the budget for fiscal year 1995 is a projection. In fact, it's an old projection. And in looking at that projection, it was our hope when we developed that 2 years ago to really be able to trim down the Department of Environmental Conservation budget and, in fact, bring our numbers of personnel down to, I believe, 430. As you'll see in the attachments for fiscal year 93, the total full-time employee numbers is 496, and the projected for fiscal year 94 is 491. And partly our efforts to reduce the staffing and budget has been offset by the increase of the obligations that have been placed on us by the Clean Air and other acts. So in some instances, as in the Clean Air Act, we really do not have a choice. That if we do not, in fact, follow the rules, we lose federal highway funds. And so that is the reality of that situation. This, of course, focuses on the operating budget, but I did want to say that the capital budget program is of extreme importance to us, and I do want to point out that we are going to be proposing to the federal government through the Environmental Protection Agency, Public Health Service, and the Housing and Urban Development thing for at least $25 million annually for water and sanitation systems. The federal government is, in fact, funding Colonies Project water and sanitation systems at $120 million this year, this current year. Colonies is the communities along the southwest and the Mexican borders, and they do have a major water sanitation problem there, but it's not really any greater than what we have here. We believe that $25 million request is a reasonable one. Finally, we believe, again, that the partnership efforts between the Environmental Protection Agency, our department, the local communities, and the legislature is going to be very important to achieving our environmental protection and economic sustainability objectives. So with that, the chair, I conclude the attempt to respond to any questions we may have, and then have the number of the staff here to respond to the questions. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I have Senators Jacko, Kutula, and Rieger. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, when the governor transmitted his capital legislation, he had included $42 million for water and sewer, which is it's a good start. I have here the recommendations from the Rural Sanitation Task Force. And as you know, the Rural Sanitation Task Force recommendations were endorsed by AFN last fall, even by the governor. These recommendations were also endorsed by the Municipal League, the Alaska Native Health Board, the Federal State Joint Committee, and many others. I'd like to ask if these recommendations are included in your operating budget, and if not, why, and specifically some of the things that are in the task force recommendations that I was particularly concerned about. There was specifically $120,000 for a remote maintenance worker in the YK Delta to service 15 additional villages. There was $50,000 in for classroom training and several other things that I'd like to know if those are included in the operating budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Jackal, I'm going to ask Keith Kelvin, our Director of Facilities Construction and Operations, to join you in with those specific questions. The Governor and the Resource Cabinet, the Facilities Cabinet, has endorsed the recommendations of the Sanitation Task Force that you referred to. We are looking for, as I say, shared funding with the federal government. I'm going to ask Keith Kelvin to respond to the specific questions on the remote maintenance worker program and any other questions you may have regarding that program.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jacko, your question, I believe, was specific to the funding for the remote maintenance worker proposed for the Western Alaska Coast. That increment is not in our budget. We're not successful in keeping it in our request. We are hopeful that we're going to be able to increasing the efficiencies of the existing grants to nonprofit corporations, be able to find monies that we can put an additional position in the Bethel area that would serve the coastal communities out there. Some of the things we're proposing, and we're working with the nonprofit corporations right now, they have to come to us with a series of reports by the 1st of February, which will identify efforts that they have made to try to expand other funding sources, other than non-general fund sources, other than general fund sources, I'm sorry, that would perhaps allow us to continue the program with less general funds in their area, or perhaps even expand it to communities as self-sufficiency is gained in some communities, expand it to areas that haven't benefited the RMW program in the past. If we're able to reach these efficiencies by other funding sources, such as local cooperatives or perhaps funding from the Native corporations themselves, we are then hopeful that we'll be able to take the existing allocation and create an additional position in the White Bay Delta. We won't know that for a while.
Mr. Chairman, if I might ask Keith to confirm my understanding, as this program was developed a dozen or so years ago, it was intended to not be a permanent program, or is my recollection correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Capito, I had a conversation with Senator Sackett last year, who was the primary sponsor of this program back in 1981. His statement to me last year was that he viewed this program as one that would be needed in a short term to allow the community to gain the self-sufficiency, and as they develop their own capabilities and the utility infrastructure and management capabilities, he had viewed it as going away eventually. It has not reached that point. We are attempting to work with the community to achieve that self-sufficiency, but I think it would be premature to say that we've reached that point. There's definitely a need for the program.
Thank you, Paul. I agree that it's definitely not time for the remote maintenance program to go away, but I'd like to have any of these recommendations been included in the operating budget at all out of the task force?
I can't speak to the other agencies' operating budgets. I do believe the commitment for capital funding has certainly been recognized and put in the budget by the administration. We are in the process of increasing our training capabilities, and the money has been set aside to do that in our next year's operating budget. So the only one that I'm aware of that we have not included funding for directly is the one that relates to the remote maintenance position. And as I said, we are hopeful to try that we're going to be able to cover that.
Senator Petrula.
Just two, there are an awful lot of people that are very concerned about ANWR. I think properly done, the hazards to ANWR are fractional, very minimal compared to what the Chuck Chi situation is. And we tie in there. Do you have any comments on potentials for drilling and spill in that area? They tell me they're enormous. With ice pack and so on, it's almost impossible to control if there is a blowout or a spill. And there's always conversation about what it amounts to, that we're going to get on top of that, and we have devised all manner of control mechanisms, but in fact, I don't see anything. And the people that talk to me feel that we're really, that's an area where we're really hanging out, that you don't want to allow for drilling, but you do got to figure out how to get on top of those other problems. I don't know. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Curtula, this is very crucial and critical. Not only does the industry have, plans and contingency plans for oil spill blowouts or whatever incidents that might occur, the Alaska Clean Seas and consortiums of industry groups, representatives of cover not only the Arctic but the other areas of Alaska, very specifically, it's essential that we continue to support and make certain that that any kind of offshore oil development does protect the environment. And we're fortunate in having Mike Conway, the director of spill prevention and response to the Coast Guard for 20 years, working closely with the Coast Guard and the federal agencies. I'm going to ask him to join us and to explain more specifically the network activities in place that provides that protection. I would say the one area of disappointment for me is the Marine Spill Response Corporation, which was established nationally, does not have a presence in Alaska. And I've talked with the congressional delegation about that, and what the congressional delegation tells us, and the Marine Spill Response Corporation tells us, is that we have better capability in controlling spills both onshore and offshore than anywhere in the country, and even better than what they expect to provide along the coast from the lower 48.
But our only protection is Prince William Sound, right?
Well, they...
I mean, you can move out airplanes and so on. Excuse me, I'm not trying to harass you.
No.
That's really, really a statement that would be worrisome, not the rest of the nation. But nonetheless, well, there's nothing going on in Chukchi that indicates that we're on top of it. If they start out there drilling and have a blowout and have a spill, there's nothing to protect them out there. And it's a very, very big and very, Arctic marine wildlife is a very, very fragile situation. I won't stay in this very long, Mr. Chairman, but we'll go to the subcommittee or something like that. That is a whole area that's being ignored while we're screaming and hollering about the problems of animal war, which is nobody's purpose is going to do a land spill unless you'll clean it up. Out there, it's real serious. Just have a few minutes from here, and then I'll get off.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, Senator Petrullo, your concerns are well taken, and it's one that we share. Can you elaborate briefly on this issue?
Mr. Chair, my name is Mike Conway. I'm the Director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. Mr. Chair, Senator Petrullo. Currently, the Alaska Clean Seas Spill Cooperative, which covers the North Slope area and any drilling operations that occur in Chukchi Sea, they have significant quantities of response gear available, and they are conducting very intricate drills. They've got an ICS structure and extensive amounts of training for that. They've taken up an initiative to look at new technologies and include in-situ burning, and they've been information, maybe the world, and looking at some of the in-situ burning tests to try and determine if it's a viable alternative, particularly in the Arctic environment. They also have mutual aid agreements with the other spill cooperatives, being Alyeska and the Cook Inlet Spill Response Organization. So those are the efforts in there to anticipate responding to those incidents. And as the Commissioner indicated, we work with the Coast Guard in exercising their capabilities. We have a requirement within the state where we review their contingency plans to ensure that they have the capability to respond. Open 90 is a federal legislation which would have the same requirements on the industry, and the Coast Guard has not yet implemented their contingency plan requirements, but we have set in motion some agreements to jointly review plans, jointly exercise plans.
Mr. Chairman, same things, same statements, and came out of the Prince William Sound area when we weren't doing anything. I don't think much is going on up there, and I think the department's worried about it. Everybody involved is worried about it. But I'll get off it.
Okay, Senator Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question in trying to understand the budget. There's a source of funds listed as storage tank. Is that a 470 fund, or is that a different fund? What kind of money is that?
Chairman, Senator Rieger, can of worms, and other things. Can I ask Janice Adair, who's the mother of all underground storage tanks, explain, and I apologize, Mr. Chairman, for dealing with this somewhat lightheartedly. It is a very serious subject, a very serious problem, and the underground storage tank, plus the 470 fund, is a story in of itself. The Janice had a story characterizing it as the mother of that program.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Janice Adair. I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation. Senator Rieger, the answer to your question is it is a separate fund within the general fund. It was created by the passage of House Bill 220 in 1990. The first year of its funding, its existence, it was funded with general funds. The next 2 years, the fiscal years 92 and 93, it was funded out of the mitigation account, which is a separate account within the general fund for accounting purposes only. It's where settlements, cost recovery, any kind of fine that the state may get from a responsible party for a spill goes into the mitigation account. The mitigation account by statute may be appropriated to the response fund and generally is in its entirety. In fiscal year 92, some money was taken out of the mitigation account to fund a couple of cleanups in Senator Lincoln's district, and then it was also taken out for the storage tank assistance fund. That money is then the storage tank assistance fund used to fund grants to owners of regulated underground storage tanks.
I can follow. So in FY 92 or to date in FY 93, how much money has come into the mitigation account before being appropriate, in round numbers?
I really couldn't answer that question and have any assurance of being even remotely correct, but I'd be very happy to get back to you.
Okay, so but to track the money, okay, the money comes into the mitigation account and then it's appropriated either to the 470 fund or to the storage tank fund. And those are two separate funds that receive money from the mitigation account?
That's correct.
Okay. And so what's happening in this budget for FY94 is that there's anticipated to be roughly $6 million appropriation from the mitigation account to the storage tank fund, and then they're appropriated to grants?
Mr. Chairman, so you that is
correct. Okay. I guess the only other question I have is, so basically, your program, because it rolls it all up into this new SPAR component, your program for FY94 doubles the storage tank activity in rough numbers, because I think last year, I can only tell from reading the funding rather than reading the budget, because it's all rolled up, but you're doubling the funding.
No, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rieger, last year the storage tank assistance fund received $5.5 million out of the mitigation account, so it's roughly the same number. I just today received the short form, so I can't address what it is precisely you're looking at.
Well, what I'm looking at, and this is actually from Ledge Finance, but in the front section, mm-hmm. they show that in FY93, there was $3.8 million as a source of funds listed as the storage tank fund, but next year it was $6.691 million.
Okay. Right. Mr. Chairman, Senator Rieger, there was a glitch in the budget last year, and while the appropriation was made in the front section, DEC did not receive authorization in the back of the budget to expend that money. We went forward to LBNA for authorization to expend the money, and we received the first authorization for a part of it, the $3 million, if I recall, in June, and then the balance we just received And we got that authorization not too long ago.
Okay.
So I believe that it was the RP process that affects that.
Okay, so it's just not reflected. Okay, thank you. I have a question on something different, and I don't know if you're the right person or not, but I'll ask it to the commissioner. I also, again, looking at the sources of funds, see that the program receipts are to go from $2.5 million roughly to $3.9 million. Could you qualitatively describe what the sources of the increases are, new fees or higher fees? Or
Mr. Chairman, the increase there is through the AIR program. The Clean Air Act amendments require that the AIR program be totally self-supporting through permit fees that permittees will pay to actually a dedicated fund that can be only used for the support of the program. So that is the increase there.
The rest of the program receipts program is pretty much unchanged, correct?
That is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pierce.
Thank you. A couple of questions on your handout, Mr. Pierce, there. On page 4, under subsection K, you say that the department's interested in strengthening the financial responsibility requirements associated with spills. After the Exxon Valdez, we quickly increased the fines for crude, but we chose at the time not to try to change those for non-crude petroleum because we weren't sure of all the toxicity questions. We didn't know what amounts were proper. Are we going to see a bill? Is that what you're speaking to? And are we going to see a bill introduced to make those changes this year?
That was not what I was addressing in this. You could ask Mike Conway could join me again to deal with that possibility because he may be considering that. What I was alluding to here in K is the emergency response capability in the Department of Defense and the Military and Veterans Affairs, specifically the Division of Emergency Services and the Department of Environmental Conservation. The Department of Military and Veterans Affairs has, and the Department of Emergency Services within it, Division of Emergency Services, have the responsibility for emergency responses stemming from natural disasters. Our responsibilities stem from oils and hazardous substance spills. And I chair the State Emergency Response Commission. We have moved to make that State Emergency Response Commission more coordinated effort with General Cox co-chairing that. I do believe we need legislation to better integrate the activities and specifically make that State Emergency Response Commission in all hazards response commission that will deal not only with oil, hazardous substances, but disasters that stem from spills that stem from natural disasters. So specifically what we've been working for since Shaker 3 is the possibility of having a 24-hour response center at the Fort Richardson Armory, to where 24 hours a day there would be both the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Division of Emergency Services, the staff are working together to respond to a natural disaster that would include a number of spills as well. So that's what I was alluding to, and I don't believe we actually have a legislative proposal to achieve that objective, and I'm uncertain whether or not the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs has a proposal. Because of the technicality of the lease arrangements, Department of the Military and Veterans Affairs. In fact, we were asked to leave the armor. We have, I think, about 5 people that were located there. And the leasing arrangements that the Department of Defense had, the arrangements for the Division of Emergency Services to be within there, did not, it was confined to them. And we've been working with General Cox to be able to have our group there. And I don't know if you can update from me as well as the status of that problem, but do we have any legislative proposals such as that of the ordinance?
On the financial responsibility requirements, there are no proposals. What we've been doing, the deputy commissioner and I have been working with the reinsurance industry and the insurance industry to fill the problematic areas with people being able to obtain the direct action clauses in their insurance policy. So we're pretty close to resolution in our negotiations with the industry on that. As far as the an all hazards commission and relationships with EMBA, DES, the director of DES and I are working on a proposal for both commissioners' consideration on a strategy for anything that would come out on any statutory changes that would be required, if any. It appears as though with the statutory responsibilities with DES and the statutory responsibilities with DEC, as bases are covered, we need to look at how the best way to structure that. So it's premature at this point to get into that. We have ironed out at least my latest information on our location situation has been ironed out.
I just have one other question on page 3, and I think it's mentioned elsewhere under subsection F, talking about the Wellsville settlement and the trustees and the department, and I assume you, Commissioner, as one of the 6 trustees, are interested in developing Prince William Sound as a world-class recreation area, and I'm curious as to what that means to you, because I think certainly there's a segment of the population that thinks that it's already a world-class recreation area and ought not have any amenities added. When you say develop an area, what does that mean and where are the trustees headed?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pierce, we, at our last trustee council meeting, gave direction to the restoration team to develop a proposal for consideration of our February 16 meeting on what the concept of a world-class recreation area would be. The restoration plan draft itself includes a description of that, but the plan will not be approved actually until December. But I was anxious to have the restoration team develop the concept of my thoughts on the world-class recreation area for Prince William Sound would be principally this, to develop facilities, including the network trails, to include the recreation facilities like docks, such as is actually has been agreed to at both Tetlick and Chenega Bay, from part of the monies from the settlement of the LAS settlement. We believe there should be a opportunity for recreation boaters in the southern part of Prince William Sound to be able to dock and service their facilities. I actually believe it's very possible, for example, that the new administration, Clinton administration, would be having a service kind of a program somewhat along the lines of a conservation corps, which you might again be in a situation or circumstances where communities and states will have the opportunity to build recreation facilities, including campgrounds, picnic areas, and what. One of the motivating factors that prompted me to press for the restoration team to describe this this concept is the ability to have something in place that would enable the state to work with the federal administration developing a system of recreation facilities, docks, campgrounds, picnic areas, trails, and so forth, that would enable recreation boaters and others to more effectively utilize that area. But we do not want to exclude, in fact, we want to encourage the private investment capital into the development of facilities like lodges or fuel dispensing facilities, but for those activities like trails or campgrounds and picnic areas, we believe that the federal and state government could do that. We believe Exxon Valdez funds would be appropriate for that purpose.
If I could just follow up on that, what are we doing to work with the actual people of the villages that were most affected, and certainly Nate to Chevrolet? Like, well, I understand that there's an agreement that we build dots in all those places. Frankly, I think we're going to do a battle over how that really gets appropriated, and I suspect that it's not going to happen this year, but which is unfortunate. But what are we doing with those corporations, the regional corporations, something to provide jobs to those people? I'm real concerned. We talk about recreation opportunities in the private sector, and frankly, I've seen the private sector tourism industry in our state vertically integrate to the point where it's very difficult for the individual, particularly in a village, to get involved in the industry. They can't afford it. They absolutely cannot compete with the cruise ship lines that have taken over kind of cradle to grave tourism in the state, and they channel the tourists so much that they never have a chance to see the mom and pop operation. Now, what are you doing to work with the actual people in the region to make sure that they have opportunities? Because they're the ones I'm concerned about.
Chairman, Senator Pearson, your points are well taken. I agree with you on that. We are dealing with that in several ways. First, the public advisory group that has been established includes representation from local communities. Chuck Todorov from Santa Cruz and Geneva Bay. And so we are involving them. The second opportunity is when the restoration proposals and plans are developed, we solicit the comments and proposals from local communities, include them in our teleconferences at each of the meetings, and we also are working toward the objective of strengthening the work plans for both 93 and 94 that achieves that objective. With regard to Cordova, again, this is one of project, you'll be able to respond to the proposal to build the road out to the harbor that will allow ships to dock is a part of that. And finally, I think it's going to be time to involve the oil spill mayors, so those mayors that are affected by the oil spill. Play a more significant role. Those are a few of the things that are being done. As you know, any action by the trustees has to be unanimous action of the trustees, and I believe that they were successful in this last meeting to get a number of projects that are locally based. In addition, I believe we need to support efforts like mariculture and others that strengthen the economy of the local communities. The definition of restoration of injured resources and injured services moves off to the point of where they come into question, and then it becomes a legal determination of actually whether or not the proposal meets the consent decree requirements. But I agree that there must be more participation in the local community.
Senator Adams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like is on the Project Chariot, just a report and a timeline for that particular cleanup. You can send that in writing. Okay, I appreciate that. In your department, we have a new budget structure here between environmental quality and our program division, and one of the things that we have gotten to is appropriation versus allocations into lump sums there in each of these divisions. And my question is, how can the public and the legislature here be assured
that the money that is approved will be spent for specific programs and not for bureaucracy. Specific programs like contaminated sites, the storage tanks, and not just used for bureaucracy, but for those specific programs. Is it necessary that this finance committee needs to look at going back to the allocation system?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, I guess the demands of the bureaucracy too often, I guess, drains funds that that both the administration and the legislature would expect to be applied to projects. Well, that's supposed to be my job and the job of the other commissions to keep those things in check. I believe we've done a reasonably good job in trying to reduce the overhead or the bureaucracy as you describe it. I guess I'd ask for some specific areas of concern that you might have, and we'd be pleased to, quite frankly, discuss with you the actual achievement of targets versus the overhead. The state does not have, the Department of Environmental Conservation does not have in place the effective program that we would like to have that identifies specific targets with allocations. I believe we're doing an excellent job in facilities construction and operation, and the so-called bureaucracy there is very low. The area of concern that I have is to some degree in projects such as Project Chariot and clean up contaminated sites and in Mike Conway's area of emergency response, spill prevention and response activities. We're waiting, of course, for the disaster to happen, trying to prevent it. And we welcome any guidance that you might have with respect to the size of that bureaucracy or the bureaucracy. I think if you look at the program over time from 1994, and reflect on the additional requirements of federal government is to hold the promise that we've been fortunate to hold the line. When I came on board, we had about 515 employees. We're now down to projected 496, 491. I had projected 495, 430. We're not going to achieve it because the federal government is mandated that we, for example, hire 27 new air personnel. Long-winded answer, I'm not trying to be evasive, but that's a difficult problem.
Yes, that's a policy decision there between appropriations and allocations, and I have some concerns there. My last question happens to be with Cooper Bay, and that is the question is, what is the department doing to prevent disasters such as in Cooper Bay with the water contamination?
Yes, Senator, is Senator Adams, Mr. Chairman, that was a tragic incident. Investigation, of course, was made, and the fault of that is actually the whole case is under litigation for damages. The lesson that I have learned from that is that, one, we just must have locally trained individuals to not only be able to keep the operation and maintenance of facilities that are in place, but actually be able to detect faults that occurred. In that instance, the fluoridation poisoning occurred, my understanding that the actual mechanism of the fluoridation in the water tank itself, the fluoridation addition was continuing to add fluoride to the tank, the and the tank itself is not having water. Laboratory had detected increasing levels of fluoridation, and the community was just a public health facility, a public health service facility, and the community was notified that there was a failure in the actual correction of that problem. And I think the inadequate training locally on the ground is the message. We must have local maintenance and operation capability to avoid that kind of problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lincoln?
Thank you. I have a couple of questions here, and I appreciate very much what the Senator's Jacqueline Pierce's comments were, because that was a couple of the things that I had written down. I think in the travels around the state that what I hear more and more is, and you hit on it in your presentation, is modification of existing laws and regulations which will lessen the cumulative impact on environmental regulations on the lives of smaller communities. Over and over and over again, I think the number one concern was the EC, that we are over-regulated and we're being regulated in rural and bush communities based upon urban Alaska. And when we talk about what's being imposed by those individuals in Washington, D.C., I think we also have the same impact in this state legislature from people who are unfamiliar with rural and bush Alaska and making laws that are a sweeping regulation of the whole state. How are you, the question that I have is when you say that the department is going to assist in the modification of existing laws and regulations, have you already begun, has the administration formulated some modifications that you're going to be presenting, or you're working with legislators on that, serving the largest area of communities? I have not heard of it, if that is so. And then going back to what you said about the identifying what water and sanitation systems they want and what they will be able to operate and maintain, I think that if we as the state looked at what we in each individual community, what we want and what we can operate and what we can maintain, would certainly lessen the bureaucracy that we've got going on. So when you do talk about developing a Prince William Sound world-class recreation area, I serve the Prince William Sound, and I have not heard in all my travels throughout that area any discussion about a world-class recreation area. I have not heard one iota about that. And some of the individuals that you spoke of being involved, I've talked with. We need, if this is something that is going on, we need the input of those individuals within those communities. Do they want it? Can they maintain it? Can they operate it? Instead of us imposing upon the communities of Alaska, I think we need to get away from that. So, and then lastly, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I didn't quite understand your the breakdown in the operating budget that you've got in the back from 90 to 95. The first one in 90 shows village safe water, and then after that it dropped out completely. And I wondered where that went.
Let me take those, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lincoln, one at a time. Insofar as the lessening the burden of on small communities, I agree totally with what you say, and we have explored with the Department of Law a possible legislation that may bring this to pass. As noted in my testimony, this I think there's an opportunity and need for a partnership arrangement for the legislature and the department to work together on this very specific problem. And we would welcome working with you in identifying options for dealing with this problem. Share with you the draft proposals that we made and solicit your suggestions. So we'd be pleased and glad to work with you. And I no doubt would endorse a proposal that would lessen this impact. It's real. It's burdensome. And it's got to be addressed. And it's not just enough to say, well, the federal government is imposes on this and we're going to do it. I think we have to grow, as is happening in some other states. I believe in South Carolina specifically is drafted a legislative proposal nationally, and I believe it would be appropriate for the Alaska legislature, either by resolution or some other means, endorse some national effort like that. This is not just an Alaskan problem, but it's especially an Alaskan problem that we need to work with other states that have small rural communities that are burdening them. The second question that you raised had to do with maintenance in the local communities. As I believe you know, we have a special training program for operation and maintenance, the water and wastewater advisory board that designs our training. We give major emphasis to that. And I think it just needs to be fully supported. You're obviously more familiar with our situation in local communities, but Kelton tells me that in some communities there are simply not the individuals that are available for training. And I guess I would again ask that you work with the fire department in identifying ways in which we can actually get more maintenance capability local. In with respect to the operating budget, particularly the 1994 charts that were appended to my testimony, this of course deals with the operation budget as opposed to the capital budget. The components of you're looking at fiscal year 93.
Well, I just noted that in FY90, Village Safe Water is there, and then after 90, it drops down.
Well, I think Keith wants to explain. It's incorporated in facility construction and operation. Do you want to elaborate on that? In other words, that Village Safe Water is enveloped in a different title. Facility construction and operation.
That's the other question that I had, again, related back to Senator Pierce's comment on the world-class recreation area of having people involved in that whole process. That, I'll double-check, but I have not heard in travels throughout Prince William Sound that individuals involved in a world-class recreation area. I have not heard.
Yeah, well, it's an in-house thing with the trustee council. Is about a 2 or 3 page description of the concept of the draft restoration plan. Certainly the restoration, the trustee council advisory committee will not only review it, but each of the communities that are involved. All I
I'd like a copy of that.
Okay.
Senator Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I guess some of my concerns in the budget one of them is the addition of this 25 or so staff for setting up the personnel for the Clean Air Act, if we pass that. And I guess my concern is brought about by past experience looking at the water quality regulations she got herself into and went overboard and made them tougher than a lot of other areas in certain instances of the quality of water to be used by small businesses and so forth. I look at some repressive regulations, in my mind, repressive regulations that occurred as a result of some of the environmental liability laws that we've passed in the last 3 years and the impact on small businesses. This old dog's jumped through a lot of hoops, but I'm not so sure I'm prepared to jump through this hoop on the Clean Air Act at this time because of the fact of what we were told last year, that it was not any more severe than the federal, and it turned out to be several areas that were. So I have read with great interest the reports from the interim task force and their work, and applaud them for what they come up with. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm going to be really proven that this is no more severe in any aspect than the federal minimum requirements. When we're talking about that kind of money for starters, for 25 new people for starters, really concerns me. My other question is a comment on strengthening financial responsibility requirements associated with such spills in K on page 4. Having seen the adverse impact on legitimate small, long-time owned Alaska businesses in the past as far as selling or hauling or storage or disposing of toxic or hazardous materials, that they virtually have been put out of that business because of the liability requirement, and you have to be a national corporation to even qualify to do this anymore, and be half nuts to even do it then. But I just, that statement sort of concerns me on where you're coming from on strengthening financial responsibility requirements in regard to handling toxic and hazardous substances and so forth. But I don't know, maybe liability insurance, environmental liability insurance is more readily available, but we had testimony and resources come here a couple of years ago that even Lloyd's wasn't even interested in providing that at any price. So I don't know if there's an update on that or if in practice you have to be a large company with a big enough bottom line of net worth to even self-insure, which is no cost to them. So that's, I don't know where you're coming from, I would say.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharp, with respect to the Clean Air Act, I appreciate your concerns with regard to that act, and especially the addition of 25 people. The committee that has developed the act that's now before you, I think is trying to reach the balance of developing, of implementing the Clean Air Act Amendments of 1990 under Alaskan conditions. And I urge that as hearings are held on that bill, that you really scrutinize that carefully. And I'd say they worked long and hard. We endorse that proposal. There is a provision or two that appears to be an addition, but it's an addition that is intended to make this bill fit Alaska conditions. So we would like to, in fact, provide a separate briefing on that. With respect to this matter of strengthening financial, well, let me say, just as an additional point, I did ask Senator Stevens to actually ask the Congressional Research Service for a financial report on the impact of the Clean Air Act nationally. I said, it's inconceivable to me that the state of Alaska, which has only 500,000 to 600,000 people, would have to make these kinds of investments. And to project that nationally is being realistic. I mean, we have to hear from them, but it's extremely burdensome and a major problem for the administration and for me personally. These Clean Air Act permits that have to be developed are actually 2 to 3 inches thick, and that's, of course, it relates to the fees. But anyway, try to keep an open mind on the Clean Air Act. It's a good bill. Personally endorse it, and the administration endorses it in its present form. It might unravel if additions are made to it, and I'd be concerned about that. With respect to the phrase strengthen financial responsibility requirements, the word strengthen may be inappropriate. What I mean to say is that we've got to deal with these financial responsibility requirements, which particularly small operators, roadhouses and whatnot, and small service station operators cannot even get insurance. And so they're left out hanging to dry. I met this Saturday morning with John Cook DeSaro, the cleaner there at Sterling. And they spent over $300,000 in cleaning up. He's got a new station now, and actually his burden for debt beyond that will pass on to his heirs. We would really like to work with you and other members of the legislature to deal with this matter, and so that actually particularly small businesses might be able to secure insurance, and even in the larger, some of the larger outfits are not able to get insurance. And as a consequence, what's happening is that we are having small communities that are no longer even able to have businesses. I apologize for that word strengthen. If it comes across as we're trying to raise the financial responsibility requirements, what we want to do is make sure that the financial responsibilities are appropriate and real, and that those who cannot get financial responsibility coverage, that we take some mechanisms to allow that to happen.
Senator Pierce.
Thank you. I just have one follow-up question on maintenance. Senator Lincoln and I seem to be thinking on the same lines this morning. You were talking about working with the communities on their water and sewer in terms of both maintenance, also management, and working with communities on making sure that once we have a system in place that it is maintained and operated efficiently and effectively. I note with the Alaska Energy Authority, well, I understand that all utilities aren't the same. The Energy Authority has the same sort of component to work with villages on their electrical power needs. The APUC even has a component for working with areas that have utilities. And now in the budgets, Community and Regional Affairs is asking for two new positions to work on management of utilities. What are the departments doing to work together on that? I envision four different agencies going in four different directions, and perhaps there are some synergies that we should be gaining in terms of utility management and operation, certainly.
Senator Pearson, Mr. Chairman, there is redundancies in numbers of people that go to communities, and especially in the areas that you mentioned. The primary mechanism that we have to deal with this problem is what's called a rural development mini-cap, in which Commissioner Edgar Blatcher chairs that group and is working to better coordinate that those activities. All of our projects themselves, as we develop them in water and sanitation systems, are developed jointly in consultation with Community and Regional Affairs, and so we worked with Commissioner Blatchford and his staff in the development of that. We also utilize Commissioner Blatchford's advice in assessing the capability of communities to operate and maintain facilities and to have the business capability of, in fact, collecting fees and maintaining programs.
Keep one of that reason. Commissioner, thank you. Senator Pierce, Mr. Chairman, we are doing quite a bit along the lines of coordination, as you suggested. We have an active MOU that we just developed
about July with PCRA, U.S. Public Health Service, and we have asked the Los Energy Authority to become part of that organization as well. At this date, they're not a signatory to it. However, they have been participating in our efforts. What we're doing, we're joining the training resources in a comprehensive effort to go out and provide the same type of service to the local government. Primarily, it's the training that will be directed for city administrators and city clerks to push the utilities on a paying basis, get some ordinances out there that allow them to collect the user fees, and direct those user fees back toward the operation of the utility. They'll pay their electric costs, the chemical costs, the operator costs, get replacement parts on schedule, order their fuel oil. So it's basically putting the utilities on a business basis so they do know how to operate it and can afford to maintain it as it should be to protect the state's investment. So we are working closely with all these other agencies. At this time, it's not 100% of the way there yet, but we expect it will be by the end of this year. We are putting together an inventory of all the available training, which is available to any and all communities and government agencies, so they know whether training is available. And we have scheduled three of the, or have actually conducted three of the joint training efforts, one in Bethel, one in Kodiak, and I forget where the third one is. But we have four more scheduled for the first half of this fiscal year.
Senator Kelly.
Commissioner, it's been 3 years since Exxon Valdez hit the rock, and outside of the new Alyeska response plan where they spent up to $50 million, and certainly the state can't take any credit for that, what have we done to lessen Alaska's vulnerability to major oil spills throughout the state?
So there have been 3 years, and actually more, and I wish I could sit before you and tell you that this will not happen again. We've taken a number of actions which to reduce the likelihood of the spill. And I ask my colleague specifically numerous things. But from my perspective, let me tell you where the areas are covered and why I think we're better prepared. I'm not 100% sure that this is not going to happen again, but the fact is we've had 18, now 20 with the recent grounding of in the Shetland Islands. In the last 30, we have 20 ships that have now released more than 10 million gallons of oil over the last 30 years, and two within the last month, I believe. At the state level, we've got, of course, our own state capability in the spill prevention and response organization. But we're working with also the Alyeska team that's in place. We have also the regional citizens advisory committees that are key players in this. We have not just the Alyeska, but we have Cook Inlet Spill Response Incorporated, we have the Alaska Clean Seas Organizations, and as I alluded to earlier, with regard to the Marine Spill Response Corporation, which is under the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, developing a nationwide system and trying to get their presence in Alaska, they have told us that we have the best capability in the country to deal with oil spills. And,
yes, but that's the Alyeska plan, essentially. What's the state got in place?
What does the state have in place? Well, we have the Joint Emergency Response Commission, the State Emergency Response Commission itself deals with oil spill and hazardous substances. That commission is a working commission. We not simply meet, but we also have in place local emergency planning districts and local emergency planning committees that identify the hazards for and the potential for spills. We have in place these committees which work to detect areas of potential weakness in our prevention mechanisms, and we're working with the local communities in development of response capabilities. I believe that you were responsible for legislation which provided the authority for construction of response depots. And unfortunately, we do not have any depots in place yet, but through the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, I believe at least $800,000 is expended for the for equipment to better prepare the state. And I'll ask Mike Conway to specifically give you a report. In fact, anticipating a discussion of this, we do have a summary of the work that's been done. Mr. Conway, can you join us in specifically outlining the activities that have taken place with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs in establishing the response depots?
Before we get back to that, how much of the DEC money, how much is DEC asking for out of the 470 fund this year? Balance now in the spill reserve fund, in the 470 fund. You know, the idea was to get to $50 million and then just get the nickel a barrel every year to keep the $50 million whole. Do we have $50 million sitting in a balance account somewhere?
26, I believe.
Well, the spill reserve during fiscal year 93 is about $23 million that are projecting for 94 to be a little over $27 million.
So, somewhere here I read that we have collected $94 million on that 5 cent a barrel since we instituted it. And out of that 94, all we have left is 23. We spent the rest.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kelly, that's my understanding of the amount that's been appropriated so far. I can't speak to other activities prior to last fiscal year, what's been on during that period of time, and I'm not sure the budget process in prior years, the process now is that it has been appropriated during fiscal year 92 and 93 to the agency. All the amounts were appropriated there except for the Department of Transportation amounts that went into the response ferry and then an amount that went into the Citizens Oversight Council, which reports to the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding, Senator Kelly, that my recollection is 3 years ago, the response fund level was something like $6 million, and we then raised it to 12. And as Mr. Conway pointed out, the balance is now 23. Our hope was to try to get it up to at least 30 million. We were very conscious of the intent, in fact, to try to raise that fee to raise that balance to at least 30 million, and preferably the 50 million level. But it should be noted that that fund has been utilized for, you know, a number of purposes, including the underground storage tank.
Where did the authority to use the money for the underground storage tank come from?
Well, as a matter of fact, I believe we have an endorsement of our budget proposal through the legislative process. Our recommendation initially 2 years ago was that we establish a separate fund for underground storage tanks that would actually assess a fee at the wholesale fuel level. But it was the judgment through the legislative process that the deep money is being used.
I'm new to the Finance Committee, so I need a little help here. $24 million sounds a little low from the numbers I've been seeing in all these papers about how much money is going to be utilized this year for the 470 Fund. Is that right? I mean, does that sound about right? They're only asking for $24 million out of the 470 Fund?
Well, I think that's...
Total? All the state agencies and everything, right?
No, it doesn't sound low to me. It sounds somewhere in the ballpark of what's been spent.
On
an annual basis.
Okay. But what's this figure? 42?
That's about its annual approximation that year's income.
It's clear that this is an unusual. This is an unusual budgeting mechanism. The money flows through. It's not like our normal general fund, and we do, in my opinion, need to get a much better understanding as a committee of this whole area. And I certainly intend to accomplish that at the subcommittee level as we move through the budget process. Terrence Kula.
I had the opportunity of offering the funding mechanism legislation, and I think Senator Kelly, the intention based on the flow through the pipeline was that we picked up close to around $30 million a year. And I think it comes pretty close to that. I think maybe as high as 32, but around 30 million.
That $24 million, that operating, is there any capital expenditures being asked for out of the 470 Fund also?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kelly, there are some amounts in there. For instance, the spill response ferry, the $7.5 million, goes directly to the Department of Transportation. That amount is the same amount as it's gone the previous year.
That's above the 24. It's part of the 24.
Yes, sir. And there's some contaminated sites, money for the contaminated sites cleanup program is in there.
So, we're using the 5 cent a barrel pipeline surcharge to clean up contaminated sites?
That's correct.
Okay. I'd like to know where the authority from that comes from. I mean, where in law does it say the DEC can ask for that money to be used for that purpose? And perhaps it's there. I know that when we set it up, that was not the purpose of the fund. Let's get back to the SPAR program for a second. After 3 years, we have no depot set up. I guess you're going to tell us why.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kelly, first of all, I'd like to explain that the state role in the spill response program is one of providing oversight and management. It's not a role of where DEC resources go out and take boats and planes and equipment and clean up spills. The arrangement set up for that is through contractors whenever the responsible party is unable to do that. So our organization is set up to provide that enforcement side of things and the coordination of the response effort for monitoring and oversight and coordination and cooperation with the federal government, the local government, and responsible parties. In addition, we have to increase the state's capability to prevent spills from happening. We have the contingency plan requirements under House Bill 567, which there's a created a response planning standard that for the industry to be able to operate in the state, they have to have an amount of equipment available, ready to deploy immediately. So through these state requirements, they've had to increase their inventories at very high levels, both in, I mentioned before, Alaska Clean Seas for the North Slope, Alyeska for the pipeline, Prince William Sound, and CISFRE, the Cook Inlet Spill Response Organization for Cook Inlet, or the of big agencies to handle the crude operations. We're negotiating currently with Alaska Clean Seas and the follow-on with the other spill cooperatives to be able to have access to their equipment. As you mentioned, there's millions and millions, $100 million has been spent by the industry to increase its capability to respond to spills. DEC and BMVA have been working together to analyze that and identify gaps through hazards analyses to be able to develop what the state could afford to be able to do as far as setting up depots, of course. I have a handout for this. As the Commissioner indicated, the EMBA DES is assigned a responsibility statute for the depots and cores, but it is a partnership arrangement because the depots need to be established in high-risk areas. Those high-risk areas are to be identified in the state master plan. DEC working...
Wait, and you haven't identified in the state master plan, correct?
We have identified in the state master plan, which was approved by the CERC last fall. The target area was to have a central depot in Anchorage with other sites to be determined upon the results.